Well, Jonathan Wolf, who's some academic, said, sorry, I'm not sure exactly who he is. I just got his quote out of a book, and he said that Volume 1 is the greatest revolutionary work of the 19th century, an insurrectionary work of the highest order. And I thought when I read it that Marx would be very pleased, because Marx, he thought that his dialectical method, he says in Volume 1, is a scandal and an abomination to the bourgeoisie, because it recognises that all societies are transient, and because it does not let itself be impressed by anything, being in its very essence critical and revolutionary. And in the preface to the first edition of Volume 1, Marx explained that its object was to reveal the economic law of motion of modern society. Now, we shouldn't take from this to think that it is just a dry economic treatise. Actually, it's a witty, literary, scathing critique of capitalism. And so I disagree with some reviewers. I think Phil Gasper makes this argument in the International Socialist Review, who recommend that if you feel a bit intimidated by the theoretical opening, to go back to the end of the book and read the end of Volume 1, which is about the rise of capitalism out of feudalism, because this is easier to follow. And the trouble is that if you do this, you're not actually reading Capital. And you still have to go back to the beginning and begin to read Capital, and then you are reading Capital as Marx meant it to be read, as he said, rising from the abstract to the concrete. Because really, you can't understand the end correctly without understanding the theory, the abstractions, and the logic of the argument that precede it. And in that process, Marx gives an integrated philosophical analysis of society based on his economic theory. And so economics and the rest of society are not separate. There's not different theories dealing with all of this as discrete areas of society, but a view of the totality of the capitalist system. And so academics and others who say that, oh, Marx's analysis is, you know, it's very useful, but then they reject the revolutionary idea that the working class can and should overthrow capitalism in order to build a decent socialist society, clearly they don't understand Capital as Marx meant it. And now there's lots of debates about the method and, you know, the theory behind it all, but I'm not going to go into a whole lot of the debates. I just want to put forward what I regard as a summary of the correct position, which is based on John Rees and Alex Kalinikos, both of whom share the politics of revolutionary socialism, revolutionary Marxism that Socialist Alternative has. And so, you know, if you want to dispute what I have to say, feel free. Now, Marx and Engels took from Hegel's dialectic three central and interlinked concepts. Firstly, that society is in a constant process of change, that society constitutes a totality, and this totality is not just made up of a whole lot of different elements that can be lined up beside each other or piled up or whatever, that they, you know, that they're actually internally, the totality is internally contradictory, and what Marx called the unity of the diverse, and John Rees calls a differentiated unity. And this encouraged Marx and Engels to be always looking for the fundamental structures of society, of going beyond partial explanations of social phenomena, of looking for the contradictions which drive society forward. Now, before Marx wrote Capital, Marx and Engels already had developed a philosophical view of humanity, and this informed their inquiry into the nature of capitalism. They'd concluded that what makes us human, as distinct from the rest of the animal world, is the way we labour. In Volume 1, Marx sums up the themes that he and Engels had outlined in the 1840s. Labour is, first of all, a process between man and nature, a process by which man, through his own actions, acts upon external nature and changes it, and in this way he simultaneously changes his own nature. And so a corollary of this is that while this explains human nature, there is no sort of abstract, timeless human nature the way it's usually talked about, but humans as we find them in any particular society. So, and Marx wrote towards the end of his life, My analytical method does not proceed from man, but from the period of society given by economics. And understanding the totality of that society means breaking it down into its simplest determinations, as he says, as a preliminary to reconstructing a view of the whole, a rich totality of many determinations and relations. And all the various elements are mediated by other elements and phenomena. So mediation is the other term of the dialectic. So volume one opens with: the wealth of those societies in which the capitalist mode of production prevails presents itself as an immense accumulation of commodities, its unit being a single commodity. Our investigation must therefore begin with the analysis of a commodity. And this wasn't just some arbitrary abstraction, as Marx says in the Grundrisse, but an abstraction which grasps the specific characteristics which distinguish capital from all other forms of wealth or modes in which social production develops. And so what he's getting at is that we live in a society of generalized commodity production, and their exchange on the market is a defining feature of capital. And this is fundamentally different to all other class societies in which production was by and large for use to produce use values. And so by a thorough examination of the nature of the commodity exchange on the market, Marx elaborates the theory of value, which actually was first developed by the great bourgeois economist of early capitalism, David Ricardo. And to pare the argument down to its bare essentials, if you just think, if you have a market and you have to compare bales of wool with iron ore, with the books that we have all around us and the furniture or whatever, this can't be their use value, because everything they're used for is so different. And they're all so radically different. And so the only aspect of everything that's produced by humans is the labour that the humans have expended on them. Now, Marx wasn't so interested in prices to begin with, as Ricardo settled on, but in understanding the dynamics of the system and why it took the forms it did. He said he was looking for the real internal framework of bourgeois relations of production. And Marx disagreed with Ricardo's method, in which the abstractions, such as his formulation of the theory of value, were just juxtaposed to the living reality, with the two basically unrelated, sitting side by side. But for Marx, the abstractions are a starting point to understand and to explain the reality. And they allow us to isolate the basic features of reality, but then we have to explain how these are related to what can be observed empirically. Now, there's debates about this in philosophy, about what is the relationship of the abstract concepts that we employ to the reality. And Engels says, the concept of a thing and its reality run side by side, always approaching each other, but never meeting. In other words, the concept and the reality, they're distinct. A concept does not, therefore, prima facie directly coincide with reality, from which it had to be abstracted in the first place. It is, nevertheless, more than a fiction. And Marx and Engels argued there is a unity of theory and reality, of which I'll come back to that, because first of all, the question Marx had to answer was where to start. And he and Engels argued that any society has to be understood historically. So Engels discussed the choice that faced Marx. Should he follow the development of capitalism historically, which is what he does at the end of Volume 1, or should he analyse the logic of the mature existing system? And Engels says, well, it might seem that the historical approach has the advantage of greater clarity, since indeed it is the actual development that is followed. But in fact, it would thus become at most more popular, because he says, you know, you'd have an endless task of having to follow every little eddy, every side issue to do with the historical development. He says the logical method was the only suitable one. But as a matter of fact, this is nothing but the historical method, only stripped of its historical form and its disturbing fortuities. The train of thought will be nothing but the reflection of the historical process in an abstract and theoretically consistent form, a corrected reflection, but corrected in accordance with laws yielded by the actual historical process itself. And with this method, he says, the logical development need by no means be confined to the purely abstract sphere. On the contrary, it requires historical illustration and constant contact with reality. And as he says, Marx repeatedly turns to historical examples to illustrate his points, both to the actual course of history and to the economic literature. Now, while the origins of capitalism and the fully developed system are very different, they are dialectically linked, and the commodity is a good way of linking them because, at the time of the rise of capitalism, the commodity was becoming, the key aspect of production, and it remains essential to understanding the mature capitalist system. And in the discussion of the commodity in Volume 1, Marx remains pretty much at the level of abstraction. He points out that the actual labour expended to produce these very different commodities is too varied and complex to be compared. And so he says, what actually is being compared is abstract labour. And Marx says, a use value or useful article, therefore, has value only because abstract human labour is objectified and materialised in it. And Marx says, and he says that this is the best point in his book, is that labour has a twofold character, abstract and concrete. Now, in previous societies, concrete labour was social because it produced use values. And so, people knew what you needed and they knew what people produced and whether they exchanged some of it or not. But when production is for exchange on the market, there's no reason why the concrete labour of a worker ends up contributing to society's needs, because that depends on whether the product actually ends up being sold on the market. If they remain unsold, then the labour was not social. But also, there's pressure on the capitalists to they're constantly forced to continually attempt to produce their commodities more cheaply. And so this means commodities with more abstract human labour in it, because they keep putting in machines. And if they're left behind with goods that are produced by outdated methods, they might not be able to sell the machines for what the products cost them. And so much of the labour of their workers was not social, but ends up being wasted. And so actually, abstract human labour, while it's an abstract concept, isn't just a concept dreamed up in Marx's mind. It actually dominates our lives under capitalism, as capitalists continually revolutionise the means of production, as he said in the manifesto, in order to compete with rival capitals. Now, another key concept that Marx employs is that of dead labour, which is embedded in machinery that's used to produce more products, and living or variable labour of the workers. And Marx has a detailed discussion of how dead labour merely passes on its value to new products, unlike the labour of workers, which actually creates new labour. And this new value in the form of unpaid labour is the source of all profit. Now, competition, as I said, drives the capitalist to employ ever greater amounts of dead labour in comparison to variable labour, the more machinery, the more commodities they produce in a given time. And in Volume 3, Marx follows this through to show that over time, the accumulation of ever greater amounts of dead labour will cause the rate of profit to fall, because profit can only come from living labour. And because the drive for profit fuels the capitalist investment, a fall in the rate of return of invested capital leads to crisis. Now, in the process of working through this, Marx creates a marvellous picture of the dialectical contradictions that beset the capitalist system. The more that's produced, the more it teeters towards crisis and internal ruptures. And in Volume 1, when he wants to sum up the nature of the relation of capital to workers and their labour, He summons up, I think, one of the great analogies of European literature. He says, capital is dead labour which, vampire-like, lives only by sucking living labour, and lives the more labour it sucks. And if anyone's seen the first Matrix film, they might get an image of what he means, those awful things that are living off sucking the bodies. Now, another defining feature of capitalism arises from the generalised production of commodities. Labour power itself is now a commodity, unlike other societies, and the purchase and sale of labour power is only possible because the exploited are free in two senses. The labourers have been separated from any control over the means of production, and as individuals, they can theoretically do what they choose with their ability to work. But as Marx points out, he actually, the worker actually doesn't have that freedom because they're forced to work by the dull compulsion of economic facts. But he shows how this is the result of a historical process of driving the peasantry off the land to free them from any control over means of production for factory work where they are to produce commodities. And the fundamental contradiction in capitalism is the conflict between the capitalists and the workers they exploit. But the ideology of capitalism denies this fundamental conflict and its inequality. In fact, the ideology seems to reflect the reality. It says that, we're all equal citizens before the law and all the rest of it. And Marx explains why this is the case. Because labour power appears to be sold and paid for its value, both the worker and the capitalist are just seen as commodity owners on the market, meeting as equals. And Marx says, so long as we stay in the realm of circulation, the market, which is a very Eden of the innate rights of man, where alone rule freedom, equality, and property, everyone seems to be equals, just acting to realise their own self-interest, and the exploitation is hidden from view. He says it's only when we enter the hidden abode of production, on whose threshold there hangs the notice, no admittance except on business, that it's possible to see the reality. And that reality, as Marx shows in his elaboration of the theory of value, is that all profit is produced by the unpaid labour done by workers. And you can see something he's trying to get at by thinking about the exploitation under the feudal system, where peasants worked for part of the week simply to give, the products to the lord, or they gave some of what they produced to the lord. So it's pretty obvious what's going on. The lord lives in luxury and does nothing and gets their produce for his effort. Under capitalism, we seem to be paid for the day because labour power, our ability to work, is just a commodity on the market, and it's, measured by the time that you work. And so its price is set by the market and not what we produce. And if workers actually were paid for all the value they produce, Marx says, in that case, no surplus value or surplus product, whatever, would go to the capitalists. And here then we come to the rub, because it says nobody would invest, because the only reason they invest is to make a profit. And so we're paid for a portion of the day, which means that we work part of the day for the boss for nothing except to make profits, just like the feudal peasants did. And this highlights a theme running through through the three volumes, that the market and the fact that labour power is a commodity like any other obscures the actual logic of the system. And the best known discussion of this is the chapter on the fetishism of commodities in volume one, where Marx asks, why is the commodity a mystical thing? Not because of its use value or the fact that human labour creates its value, because it's obvious that things are produced by human effort and things have a use. Whence then, he says, arises this enigmatical character of the products of labour as soon as it assumes the form of commodities? Simply because the relation of the producers to the sum total of their own labour is presented to them as a social relation existing not between themselves, as it was when people produced use values, that's my brackets, but between the products of their labour. A definite social relation between men assumes in their eyes the fantastic form of a relation between things. And in order to find an analogy, we must have recourse to the mist-enveloped regions of the religious world. In that world, the productions of the human brain appear as independent beings endowed with life, i.e. gods, and entering into relation both with one another and the human race. And so it is in the world of commodities with the products of men's hands. This I call the fetishism which it attaches itself to the products of labour, so soon as they are produced as commodities, and which is therefore inseparable from the production of commodities. This fetishism of commodities has its origin in the peculiar social character of the labour that produces them. Now, And, you know, so this is connected to the theory of alienation, which helps explain why workers might accept ideas that are not in their own interests. Now, I was going to use the example of the stock market as the hallmark of how the social institutions seem to have a life of their own, and then which dominate human behaviour and obscure the reality of what's going on. Because shares in stock markets, Marx points out, appear to give the owner a share in the productive enterprise. But, he says, they do not place the capital at one's disposal. It's not subject to withdrawal. They merely convey legal claims to a portion of the surplus value to be produced by it. And these become paper duplicates of the real capital. And they can be the subject of speculation, trading, as though they have a value of their own. And it's as though they acquire value separate from the origins of capital, from the original capital. And so they come to nominally represent non-existent capital. Now, sometimes they can change, you know, their value because of what's actually happening in production. But that's not necessary because speculation is just that, gambling. And so they can have their prices bid up on the stock market and then in a situation in which their value is illusory. Now, you could think that Marx was writing of our experience of the 21st century when he says, gain and loss through fluctuations in the price of these titles of ownership become, by their very nature, more and more a matter of gamble, which appears to take the place of labour as the original method of acquiring capital wealth. And there was actually an example just recently on the 11th of April when a rumour got started that BHP Billiton was planning a takeover of Woodside, and there was mad speculation in both their shares, and the Woodside shares fluctuated by $4 billion over one day and closed 90 cents dearer, and the BHP Billiton shares went up 3.7%. There was absolutely no information to imply that these were really worth any more, and in fact the rumour proved to be unfounded. And so billions of dollars exchanged for no other reason than a rumour. And this brings us to the distinction that Marx made between the essence or the objective reality and the surface appearance of things. Now, Hegel insisted that the appearance of things does not have an independent reality from its relationship to the essence. And this was an important concept for Marx, who concluded that you can only understand the appearance of things when you actually identify the essence. Now, it's often thought that the appearance is something simply fake, that it's not real. In fact, Hegel thought that the appearance was an illusion, what John Rees calls the thought essence in its otherness. But Marx could see that the appearance is real just as well. He says, for example, the market is not an illusion. It's a social institution which grows out of a social relationship surrounding generalized market production. And Rees says, the market appearances are no less real than the internal structure of capitalist exploitation. Marx's project is to show how the one produce the other and in what ways they depend on each other. Excuse me. Now, by understanding how the market obscures the actual social relationships in capitalism, we can understand why it's so difficult to see the actual way the system works and, as I said, why workers might lack class consciousness. The lack of control the workers have over any means of production, even over their own labour power and how it's to be utilised, is the reason for what Marx called alienation, the concept related to commodity fetishism. And alienation breeds passivity and subservience to figures of authority and a sense of powerlessness in the face of the power of the bosses. Commodity fetishism, on the other hand, turns everything from the products of labour to creativity to sex, even our thoughts, into commodities and mystifies the social relationships between people. And so by the exploration of the internal structures of capitalism and the appearances it gives rise to, we have the material basis for explaining why workers accept ideas which are contrary to their own class interests. Now, in volumes 2 and 3, Marx moves beyond the abstract model in which commodities exchange for their value. He says in the Grundrisse, capital exists and can only exist as many capitals. In other words, there's no individual capitalist that can just control the economy. And what epitomises this sphere of many capitals is competition. And so the analysis of competition completes Marx's picture of the production process. Now, he points out in a number of places that what makes money capital is its self-expansion of value. But to realise the surplus value created by their workers, the capitalist has to sell the commodities on the market. And while value is a measure of the abstract labour power it contains, the price of the commodity is determined by the competition on the market. Now, have they produced at the social average, or has someone produced the same or substitute commodity more cheaply? Have too many rushed to invest in new industry, all the things I started with? Is there a slowdown in the economy, which means that there are fewer buyers, and so on? And so competition drives the capitalist to an unplanned, the capitalist system to an unplanned anarchy in which the social character of labour is judged, you know, on that market rather than by consideration for human needs. Then there's the rate of profit, and it illustrates how competition again conceals the real social relations and where surplus value and therefore profits come from. Because the capitalist works out their return by looking at their total outlay, giving the appearance that both the constant and the, or the dead labour and the variable labour contribute to this surplus value. But there's also more to the rate of profit than just that mystification, because in each industry, there are different organic compositions of capital. In other words, different degrees of investment in dead labour compared with living labour. And in volume three, Marx outlines the process which leads to what he calls an equalisation of the rate of profit across the system. Capital flows in and out of all different sectors, and that tends to even out the differences in the returns. And so the result is a general rate of profit, because otherwise, why would a capitalist invest in a industry that has a high organic composition of capital? Because if profits come from living labour, the profit rate should be lower. And so why would you invest in steel mills in a rich country rather than textile sweatshops in Asia? And Marx says, the incessant outflow and influx via which capital is constantly redistributed from industry to industry continues until it creates such a ratio of supply and demand that the average profit in the spheres of production become the same, and values are therefore converted into prices of production. And this general rate of profit reflects the total surplus value created in the economy compared with the total capital invested across the whole economy. And so capitalists get not their share of the total pool of surplus commensurate with the organic composition of capital in their enterprise, but in proportion to the total capital that they outlay. And Marx says the sum of prices of all commodities produced in society is equal to the sum of their values. And it's all of this that shows us why the price of commodities consistently diverge from their value. And so, of course, the law of value, which we started with at an abstract level, has to be modified. Now, one of Marx's most controversial conclusions was that there was a general tendency of the rate of profit to decline and therefore to regular crises in the system. And in the real world, Marx always acknowledged that this is only a tendency. And so he had to take account of all the mediating influences. And so he lists a whole range of countervailing factors, as he calls them, to the general tendency for the rate of profit to fall. I'm just going to look at three main ones and then talk about the main one. There's quite a few he lists. They can increase the intensity of exploitation, which is what they've done under neoliberalism. But there's limits to this because it can you can kill your workers, or you can end up with shoddy work from skilled workers. They're forced to work too fast and all the rest of it. There's the depression of wages below the value of labour power. In other words, what it costs to reproduce the working class. But again, there are limits to this because you can provoke resistance or you can debilitate the workforce. Then there's the cheapening of the means of production. And this causes problems for individual capitalists because, you know, if someone else is renewing their machinery more quickly than you are, you get left behind with products you can't sell. But the most important factor in terms of dealing with this tendency for the rate of profit to decline is the crises themselves that it brings on. As Marx said, when things are going well, the equalisation of the rate of profit ensures that each shares in the common loot in proportion to the size of his respective investment. But once it's a question of sharing in losses, Everyone tries to reduce his own share to a minimum and shove it off upon others. The class as such, he says, must inevitably lose. How much the individual capitalist must bear of the losses, i.e. to what extent he must share in it at all, is decided by strength and cunning, and competition then becomes a fight among hostile brothers. And so in order to restore production to a sound basis, capital is withdrawn from production, you know, they refuse to invest. A whole lot of capital is basically destroyed by people leaving factories unused and they rot, or they have to sell it off cheaply, so its prices are all driven down, and unemployment from their point of view hopefully will cheapen the cost of labour power. And so the crisis lays the basis to begin to restore the rate of profit, and therefore investment can begin again. Now, since Marx's day, this process has continued what Marx actually understood was beginning to happen, which he called the concentration and centralisation of capital. And this has got enormous consequences for the resolution of crises today, because the threat of gigantic international corporations going to the wall makes the capitalists shiver with fright. And instead of letting them go to the wall to clean out the system and drive down the value of capital, they turn to the kind of bailouts that we saw in the global financial crisis and all kinds of other government intervention. And so it becomes increasingly difficult for the system to get back to boom conditions, which is why some of the more extreme neoliberals think that the big corporations should be allowed to go to the wall no matter what chaos and social costs it entails. Now, the other important discussion in Volume 3 is the role of credit. Now, to understand how a bank can make money from lending money, it's useful to visualise that pool of total surplus value again, created across the whole economy. Because if some capitalists don't immediately invest their cut of it, they can make it available to others who borrow it to invest. And some people just merely get enough to cover their costs while they get their production going and their products onto the market. They realise their profits, and unless they fail, the money borrowed is just repaid. And the interest comes out of the profit of the borrower. And so credit is just another way of distributing that surplus value between the capitalists, and it facilitates investment. But there are those who borrow with little or no collateral sometimes, simply their intention to produce a profit, and this is a much more unstable situation. And in the boom slump cycle, interest earning credit can at a particular point in the cycle accelerate investment and fuel a boom, as money that would otherwise lie idle waiting for its owner to invest is fed into capital accumulation. And then the boom creates even more loanable capital, keeping interest rates low. But now more of those cavaliers who operate without any sound basis begins to increase. And when the inevitable crisis sets in, interest rates rise, credit suddenly stops, payments are suspended, and the production process is paralysed. And Marx says there can be a superabundance of idle industrial capital appearing side by side with an almost absolute absence of loan capital. But once enough capital's been destroyed to cut the cost of the means of production, wages and raw material, confidence is restored, credit becomes available at low interest again, and credit can help fuel a new rise in production. But we've seen, you know, the difficulties they have today in getting that going again, and governments do interfere with this process at times, so it doesn't always work out quite the way that's outlined. But this whole process creates ever more opportunities for what Marx calls swindlers, creating a paper world in which the real price of commodities and its real basis appear nowhere. The entire process becomes incomprehensible. And so again, this can't be explained by simply looking at the madness of the credit system or the markets, but only by returning to the basis for the production of value in the system and the struggle between the hostile brothers and sisters of the capitalist class over how it will be distributed among them. So, you know, there's that whole process all the time of the abstraction and coming back to test it against reality. And you can only understand, you know, the surface phenomenon by coming to grips with the internal structures of the system. So to finish, I think the three volumes of Capital are an exposition of the Marxist dialectical method, and they show how capitalism works and that the system is unredeemable, that it can never provide a decent life for the whole of humanity. And you can see that the accusations that people aim at the Marxists, that Marx is just reductionist, reducing everything to economics, is actually based on total ignorance of this method or anything much to do with capital. Because the concept of an internally contradictory totality, with the contradictions mediated by all kinds of phenomenon which must be analysed, is completely contrary to a reductionist analysis. And so Capital, while it is very challenging to read, is worth the effort because it demonstrates that capitalism is an irrational human society. And Marx highlights this in Volume 2 when he says, if we were to consider a communist society in place of a capitalist one, then money capital would immediately be done away with, and so too the disguises that transactions acquire through it. The matter would be simply reduced to the fact that the society must reckon in advance how much labour, means of production and means of subsistence it can spend without dislocation on branches of industry which, like the building of railways, for instance, simply supply neither means of production nor means of subsistence. In capitalist society, on the other hand, where any kind of social rationality asserts itself only post festum, which I'm told means literally after the feast, major disturbances can and must occur constantly. And he concludes in Volume 3 with a summary of the internal contradiction of capitalism, which threatens its very existence. The rate of self-expansion of capital, or the rate of profit, being the goal of capitalist production, its fall appears as a threat to the capitalist production process. And this testifies to the merely historical, transitory character of the capitalist mode of production, and to the fact that at a certain stage it conflicts with its own further development, so that the real barrier to capitalist production, and in fact the real barrier to human progress, is capital itself.